Hello and welcome back to another episode of Angel Insights. Now, this is the podcast that takes you inside the world of early stage investors to reveal their tips, tactics and strategies when it comes to investing in today's best startups. And joining me today, we have Jonathan Hakakian. Now, Jonathan is the managing director and co-founder of the Soundboard Angel Fund with Richard Majid. Now, Jonathan raised capital for the fund, directed the diligence process into a growing portfolio of 20 companies and coached many of the portfolio's entrepreneurs on their journeys. His professional background also includes tech, sales, construction, and management. And most recently, he graduated from the Kaufman Fellows Program, where he focused his studies on being an innovative venture investor. And locally, Jonathan is a board member of New Jersey Entrepreneurial Network. He's also an EIR at Stevens Institute of Technology Venture Center, and he's an advisory board member of MCW, a nonprofit focused on empowering current and future leaders to better their local communities. However, without further ado, I'm delighted to hand over to Jonathan Hakakian, Managing Director and Co-Founder of the Soundboard Angel Fund. Jonathan, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show today. I've heard so much about you from different people in the ecosystem, but thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, I'd love to start today by hearing a little bit about how you made your way into the early stage investing world to start with. So what was your entry point?
So it really comes from growing up in a family-owned and operated business. The discussion around the dinner table was always about the day's work, the vision of the firm, and just what was going on. And that really stuck with me because as a kid, my background ended up being, as a kid growing up around the dinner table, my weekends, summers were always spent at the family business. So I really got exposed to entrepreneurship, more standard traditional small business from a very young age. And that carried through with me through high school and university years, which is when I started my first beautifully failed startup. And I call it that because we had one of those entrepreneurial pangs where we had this great idea, we're decent at executing it, but we're very blind to the bigger market forces at play. And this is about 10 to 12 years ago. MySpace was still king of the world. Facebook was just barely outside of seed stage. It was still in growth mode. It was nowhere near IPO at that point. And so we had this great idea. We executed on it. We're very well executed in our market of DC. But again, ultimately, it didn't move past that area, and we closed up shop. Through there, I stayed very connected in the DC, New York ecosystems for startups and entrepreneurship. Ended up meeting my current co-founder along the way, and we realized back in 2010 when I joined him that we had a shared passion for startups, entrepreneurship, and helping companies succeed and grow. He has a background consulting with much more mature companies, but still very entrepreneurial run. And when we joined, it was with specific intent on figuring out how to do that for early stage companies.
I'd love to hear your learnings, though, from the, as you said, the beautiful failure of your first startup. Were there any kind of real stark moments of realization?
there are a lot. You know, it's an MBA in a very short amount of time that costs a lot less.
Yeah, I know. I advise that to most business school grads too.
Yeah, yeah. Just working with a partner and having to deal with everything that there is to set up a business was a stark realization because I never really understood all the little pieces, the intricacies of, okay, if you have employees, you need this kind of insurance. If you dive into work into this area, you have to make sure you're covered here, or you have to have specific contracts drafted up. Getting that kind of education was immensely helpful to where I am today. That's one. The second is just how important it is to be open to evolution. What I learned very quickly was the first idea is not going to be the winnable one. Is not going to be how you're going to make it in the market. As an entrepreneur, we all have to be out there constantly learning and updating our ideas not only because the idea may be slightly flawed, but also we don't know what the customers want or what the industry wants or what the market needs until we have a foot in there, get some feedback, and continue to iterate. It's very much the lean startup and MVP model.
Do you approach that very much with your investments then, that kind of flexibility of mindset that the first iteration may not work and you're fully willing to allow for the runway to continue for the second and third iteration?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's highly important that the entrepreneurs also understand that and believe that they have something, but they got to be open to evolution. And usually by the time we see them in our process, they've evolved a half step or full step. And I don't like the word pivot, which is why I use the word evolve. I think pivot is overused in today's marketplace. And I think evolution is a little bit better of a term considering what the companies are actually doing, where they're moving their target market or what they're doing in the marketplace. It's more than just a slight shift. Sometimes it's really big, and that's where the impact really comes.
And these evolutions tend to be in the earlier stages, as we said, when we're testing product market fit, identifying customer segments. I'm intrigued to hear then, at what stage do you like to get involved with companies and make investments?
So I personally like to meet companies as early as possible because I like to know the entrepreneurs and get a relationship going with them before it's time for investment. Mm-hmm. When it comes to making the actual investment, it really helps for us to be in deep conversations with them as their quote unquote second round of capital, with that first round either being serious bootstrapping, friends and families, or some very early believers in their product or market. We like to see that there's something done in the marketplace. They're out of beta or alpha or whatever they want to call that first iteration. They've tested something in the marketplace and they've been able to show that somewhere there is a customer that will pay something for the value that they're providing, even if that's not the ultimate customer, ultimate value, but that they understand it and that they're going towards it.
I'm really intrigued. At such an early stage, I'm always fascinated by the elements in terms of ownership and valuation. So at such an early stage, what sort of ownership levels are required? And also, is valuation kind of the art that is often cited at this early stage, or is there more of a science to it, do you think?
I wish valuation was a science. It would make things a lot easier, but it's not. It is very much an art, and it is a very long conversation with the entrepreneur once we get to that stage. Usually in the early stages, we sit down with them and we say, look, where do you think your company should be valued at? Give us a range of what you're considering if they don't have a term sheet already or don't have something finite. And that's where we can gauge where they are. And if they're way out of the ballpark, I make sure to tell the entrepreneur. And if they're reasonable and they're willing to take that feedback, we'll come to terms, you know, when the time comes. And if they're not, I gently tell them, look, we're not going to be able to meet here. Go out there, raise your round. And if it ends up being at a lower valuation, come back to us. And some have, and some have just gone on and either they've not raised their round or they've raised their round from not professional, not traditional angels and VCs, which I've seen has hurt the entrepreneurs in the long run, because then a professional investor will come in and knock them down and it'll be quite dilutive and the early investors can get hurt.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in terms of kind of getting hurt there and dilution, I'm intrigued as to the ownership stakes that you think are required at the early stages. So let's start with that actually. Yeah. What level of ownership do you guys like to take?
Because we're a part of a larger syndicated round at this point, we don't really set exactly the ownership stake. The rough rules that I use are about $1 million of capital raise should be, you know, four-ish million dollar valuation. So about 20% of the company at such an early round should go out to investors.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of kind of, because it is such an early stage, and because it is, as you said, part of a large syndicated round, how do your exit or return expectations differ from, say, a much larger fund who have the $1 billion expectations? Does the expectations differ for you?
So the expectations, no. we are still looking for the 10, 20, 30x returns. What differs for us is how to get there and at what price. A lot of the companies that we invest in, we expect them to exit at $50, $75, $100 million, which for us is a home run. That's going to make us very, very happy, as well as the entrepreneurs very happy, because there aren't so many rounds of capital invested in the company. So we're hoping and we're expecting that most of the companies will be able to get there with maybe a Series A and a small Series B, or some combination of that, not $200 million of capital invested in the company.
Mm-hmm. And with the reduced amount of rounds, obviously there's a reduced amount of dilution for you, the early investors. How do you look to approach the often worrying problem for early stage investors of the dilutive element?
So we do try to think about that early on in our diligence process, and we try to make an educated assumption or guess internally, as well as a discussion with the entrepreneur, how much do they need to really be able to run the company the way they want? How much do they need for exit? And if it's outside of our realm, it's not for us. If it's, you know, if they want to be a $1 billion company and raise hundreds of millions of dollars, and there's really no other path to exit other than that, it's just not the right fit for us. But if there are other ways and there are other paths to exit, or other ways to hit those milestones or to get the company to profitability, that's where we try to be. Those are the companies that we really like.
I guess then, what is the exit time horizon for you? We often, you know, I often speak to VCs who have 10-year time horizons, because that nowadays is the traditional time for an IPO or a big acquisition. So what's the time horizons that you would place on your investments then, if they are to go at, say, Series A or early B?
Well, we try to get them to the A or B round within 2 to 3 years. So that way the exit horizon is 5 to 7 years. But we do know that it's a long run game. There's a very famous angel investor, and I always forget his name. I think it's Bill. He says, lemons rot faster than plums ripen. So we got to put in the time and have the patience for the plums to ripen. And that may take 10 years, but it's going to pay off. So when I talk to our investors, when I approach other angels in the marketplace, it really is a long-term game that could be 10 or 12 years, and we have to put in the patience and the effort to get there.
Mm-hmm. When you have the potential for an exit at, say, a $75 or $100 million valuation, is there ever a mental kind of dilemma for you that this could potentially be a much larger company, or does that go against the ethos of the investment thesis?
It becomes a discussion with the entrepreneur about what's right for the company and for the shareholders. And that's where there is a divergence of opinion, and it could become a little bit of a heavy board meeting, but ultimately what's right for the company will be right for the shareholders. And I do believe that.
I'm interested. You said about the board there, and it's often a question I get from earlier stage founders as to when should we start to form a board, and what does that kind of composition look like? Is it 10 board members? Is it 2 board members? And when do we do it? What are your thoughts on the when and the how structured?
It really depends on the company. At the earliest stages, the real pre-seed or seed rounds should be at least 3, max 5. At the seed Series A, that should be around 5 with maybe a couple observers, because the company's really excelling and they need the networks and the individual support of so many people. When it's pre-seed, it's a little easier to maneuver around 3 people, get some emergency board meetings going, get decisions done that need to be quick. There should always be investor representation on the board, even if it's not myself or one of my partners. What we do instead is we try to make sure that we have a direct line of communication with the entrepreneur and are somehow in collaboration with the company. If it's not a board seat, observer seat, or advisory role, we want to make sure that the entrepreneur knows, that the company knows we are there to support, and we want to be somewhat active. But that active relationship is a conversation during our diligence process and at closing for us. We don't want to be heavy-handed, and I have enough going on in my work and personal life. I don't need more companies to run. So it's got to be something that works for the company and works for us.
And you mentioned, obviously, the board there and the function of the board. And the function of you, again, the kind of the early stage investor with direct communication lines to the founders. Obviously, one of the main functions is to aid in the transition from seed to Series A and on. I'm intrigued if you've seen personally the supposed Series A crunch and how that affects the companies that you've worked with and kind of the commonalities of those that have approached it with success.
Yes, definitely seen the Series A crunch. It is out there. It's happening. As VCs, micro or traditional VCs, are moving more and more upstream, there's this valley of death that's happening between, you know, the seed rounds of $1 million and the Series A's, which are requiring more traction, more milestones hit, more customers, revenues, profitability, whatever it may be. The way I'm starting to look at it now is really through the lens of a company needs probably twice or more of capital that they're expecting for their seed round. So they should be raising or expecting to raise $2.5 to $3 million to get to the milestones needed for their Series A. And this is an average. Obviously, per company, per industry is going to be different. But it's getting making sure that the company can get there, whether it's through a seed round and a convertible note following, or the other way around, or just one long round. That's a discussion with the entrepreneur, but it's becoming more apparent that more cash is needed to get there. So when we talk with entrepreneurs and we are setting up these milestones and these and the path to Series A, it really is about their fundraising strategy, a lot of it, mm-hmm. and making sure that not only do they have a strategy, but they have the ability and wherewithal to last through through those tough periods.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting divergence between those that believe that you should raise as much as you can between seed and Series A to make sure you last the difficult crunch. And there's also the others who say that constraint enforces creativity and actually raise what you need and no more, because also there's dilution, obviously. Which side of the camp would you say you fall on?
I fall on the side of raise as much as you can, because I think all entrepreneurs are going to be constrained. And it's up to the investors, the board, and the entrepreneur and their key executives and team to make sure that it's not wasteful spending. So by definition, a startup with a good amount of money will be very, very tight on budget. They're not going to have all these crazy expenses. They're going to stay focused on the tasks at hand and save for the drought times and to get through the summer crunch, if that's when they're raising, because they're not going to be able to raise over the summer or the holiday season or whatever it may be, that you got to save for those times as well.
But I do want to dive into a quick fire round with you now. So I say a short statement and then you give me your immediate thoughts. How does that sound?
Okay, sure.
So let's start with your favorite investing resource. This could be a book, it could be a blog, it could be a newsletter.
So there's a term sheet, which was by Dan Premack until I think this week or last week. It's a great rundown of what's going on in the industry on a daily basis. And then one of my favorite blogs is Jerry Newman, who writes the Reaction Wheel blog. He gives some just amazing practical advice. He's down to earth. And he's also of the mindset that we don't have to always go for the super unicorns, that there's a lot of activity and a lot of great success in the companies that won't be written up on the front of Wall Street Journal.
What's the biggest challenge for you in your role?
So this is a complicated question. With an angel fund that's very democratic, the challenge is the democracy and only having one person shepherding everybody through.
Absolutely. Yep. No, that is an interesting challenge. let's finish with what's the most recent investment and why did you say yes?
So there's an investment that's going to come out for us in the next week or two. It is in the women's lingerie space. And what impressed us most about it was the two entrepreneurs, their approach to the market and the problem, and the way they're able to communicate it to their non-customer base investors, because most angel investors are male of the baby boomer age. and they are going after quite a different market.
Absolutely. No, the ability to describe the narrative. But Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It really was such a pleasure to hear more about you and your workings and investment theses. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Harry.
And I'd like to say a big thank you to Jonathan for giving up his time today to appear on the show. And if you like the show today and want to see more from Syndicate Room, then all you have to do is head over to syndicateroom.com, where you can find a whole host of articles, resources, and more podcast episodes. As always, we so appreciate you tuning in today and look very forward to bringing you next week's episode.